Hello and welcome to Greatest Britons. You're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, and the discussion today on Æthelflæd was had with Max Musson. I hope you enjoy our Greatest Briton for today, which is Æthelflæd. Let's move into our Greatest Britons segment then, and this Greatest Briton that we're going to begin this week was actually brought up by you, Max, once again. Æthelflæd, the Lady of the Mercians, who is very well respected in Mercia today. She was actually born in 870 on the 12th of June and she died in 918. And she ruled Mercia in the English Midlands from 911 until her death. She was the eldest daughter of Alfred the Great, King of the Anglo-Saxon Kingdom of Wessex, and his wife Ealhswith. And we've already talked about Alfred the Great. And I was actually surprised to see the size of Mercia. It's absolutely huge. It was Gloucestershire, Worcestershire, Herefordshire, Shropshire, all the really nice areas there on the border with Wales, stretching right the way across to the east and into Kent. It was actually larger than Wessex for a time. It was a huge part of the country, and it was a very important kingdom. But yeah, you decided that we should do Æthelflæd, the Lady of the Mercians, Max. What was your main reasoning for why you think she should be in our series of Greatest Britons?
Well, the reason is that we covered Alfred the Great a while back, and it became very apparent when we were covering Alfred the Great just what a massive contribution he made to the founding of England and to the founding of our culture, to the building up of the Christian church in Britain and to the formulation of laws. And so he obviously was a very prominent figure in English and British history. Through the research that we did when we were talking about Alfred, Æthelflæd became known to me, and I realized then that whilst Alfred the Great had this dream of creating a united England, and whilst he made great steps towards achieving that and made Wessex secure and helped to make Mercia secure, that he died long before his dream was actually realized. But he had two children. There was Æthelflæd and her brother, who was
Edward.
Edward, that's right. Yes, who then became Edward the Elder. And between the two of them, they then took his dream of a united England further forward. And so what we had was a situation in which Æthelflæd was married to Æthelred, who was the king of Mercia. And Æthelred, during Alfred's lifetime, did accept Alfred's overlordship over him. And so therefore, although Æthelred was the king of the Mercians, and although Æthelflæd was the queen of the Mercians, Alfred the Great was regarded as being their lord, effectively, and so they swore fealty to him in most respects. And so after his death, Edward, who was Alfred's son, took over the monarchy of Wessex, and to some extent he had influence with Æthelflæd and with Æthelred. Quite how much influence he had is not clearly understood, and it's often assumed that he would have continued to have exercise the same kind of overlordship over Mercia that Alfred the Great did, but I don't think that's at all clear. I think really what we had after Alfred the Great died was kind of like a partnership between Edward and Æthelflæd, and so Æthelflæd continued to be the queen of Mercia, and then when Æthelred died, she was then the sole ruler of Mercia, and continued the cooperation with Edward towards achieving her father's dream of establishing an England. And And together they built more burhs, which are the fortifications that enabled the towns and the settlements that were emerging during that period to resist attack by ravaging bands of Vikings. And they took part in a number of military campaigns and in order to extend the influence of their two kingdoms. And then when Æthelflæd died, Æthelstan, who is the son of Edward, who succeeded Edward, then became the king of both Wessex and Mercia, and also parts of Wales that Æthelflæd had drawn into alliance with Mercia as well. And so a very considerable step forward had been taken to create England as we know it today. And it was then, I think, during the reign of Æthelstan that the northern parts of England were eventually brought under his dominion as well. And he realized the dream of Alfred the Great.
So she was absolutely instrumental in fulfilling that dream and getting England all together, basically. And there was also, I mean, there's a bit of confusion of whether it was Edward or whether it was Æthelflæd, and Æthelflæd's part is sort of, it's not really covered so much in the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle, but we hear more about her elsewhere. And this is a question, is like, how do we know that she was that important? Because she barely appears in the Saxon Chronicle. Well, details of her actions were preserved in a pro-Mercian version of the Chronicle known as the Mercian Register, or the Annals of Æthelflæd, so it's actually named after her. And although that is now lost, elements from it were incorporated into several surviving versions of the Chronicle. The register covers the years 902 to 924 and focuses on Æthelflæd's actions, with Edward hardly mentioned at all, and her husband only twice, on his death and as father of their daughter. Information about Æthelflæd's career is also preserved in the Irish Chronicle, known as the Three Fragments. According to Wainwright, it contains much that is legendary rather than historical, but it also contains, especially for our period, much genuine historical information which seems to have its roots in a contemporary narrative. She was also praised by Anglo-Norman chroniclers such as William of Malmesbury and John of Worcester, and she has received more attention from historians than any other secular woman in Anglo-Saxon England. Now, it's interesting that, to me, that they've got all this information about her over there in Ireland, because that tells us how important she was. She wasn't just important in England, she wasn't just important in Mercia, but right the way over the water there. In Ireland, they're talking about her. So whether it was, you know, whether it's got lots of legendary stuff in there or not, the point is that she was obviously a very important person at this time. Well, she was, as I say, she was born around 870 at the height of the Viking invasions of England. And by 878, most of England was under Danish Viking rule, as we talked about in the series on King Alfred. East Anglia and Northumbria having been conquered by them, and Mercia was partitioned between the English and the Vikings. But in that year, Alfred won his crucial victory at the Battle of Edington. So maybe she was born, I don't know, maybe 9 months after the Battle of Edington. King Alfred might have been celebrating there with his wife. Soon afterwards, the English-controlled western half of Mercia came under the rule of Æthelred, Lord of the Mercians, who accepted Alfred's overlordship, and Alfred adopted the title of King of the English, claiming to rule all the English people not living in areas under Viking control. And in the mid-880s, Alfred sealed the strategic alliance between the surviving English kingdoms by marrying Æthelflæd to Æthelred. And then we see what is a sort of role mainly that these princesses actually had. They would be used to cement alliances with other nations or with other parts of the country. And because the daughter of that king had been married to this other prince or this other lord, then they would have like a union then, and it was supposed to prevent war, basically. And that was normally the role that a princess played. There would also sometimes be sent off to nunneries. They would swear to celibacy. In actual fact, one of the things that's said about Æthelflæd is that once she had had her son, she swore herself to celibacy after that. Most of the time they would be actually given away as princesses, and that was it. We wouldn't actually hear anything more about them. So the very fact that we've learned so much more about Æthelflæd tells us that, you know, she was this very important person. She was the exception to the rule, basically. I mean, she must have been to be written about in Ireland and to be written about elsewhere. Do you want to add anything to that?
Just say that she ranks alongside the likes of Boadicea, Elizabeth I, and Victoria as women who are critical for the development and the expansion of England and then Britain. And for the development of our culture and as great historic characters.
And also, I think it serves to show that this nonsense we're taught today, that women were just kept indoors, they weren't allowed to be educated, they were just treated as baby machines, that's not the truth. Most women wanted to be cared for, most women wanted to be protected, they wanted to be provided for, they wanted to have as many children as possible. But there were always these other women that were the exceptions to the rule, that wanted to do other things, and we never stopped them from doing that. I mean, this woman made it, she was right up there at the top there. She was written about more than her husband, who was actually the king. And as we say, this is like 1200 years ago. So it's an absolute nonsense to be told that women used to be oppressed by men. They certainly weren't. Well, one of the important things she did was rescue the relics of King Ozzy, or Saint Ozzy, from the Danelaw. Her brother Edward the Elder succeeded as Alfred, as King of the Anglo-Saxons in 899, and in 909 he teamed up with her to raid the northern Danelaw, and they returned with the remains of the royal Northumbrian Saint Oswald, which were translated to the new Gloucester Minster. The relics gave the church great prestige, as Oswald had been one of the most important founding saints of Anglo-Saxon Christianity, as well as a ruling monarch. And the decision to translate his relics to Gloucester shows the importance of the town to Æthelred and Æthelflæd, who were both buried in St. Oswald's Minster. And she actually rescued more relics than St. Oswald's. There are quite a few relics that she managed to take back from the Danes. Now, I don't know if when the Danes moved into an area, the relics were already there in a church, or whether the Danes had actually kidnapped these relics, because they were obviously very important to the Saxons at the time, that they had these remains of their saints, because the miracles would happen around these things, and they would believe that if they didn't have their relics with them, they were going to suffer bad luck, because, you know, something that was to do with Christianity had been taken by these pagans, so they would get bad luck until they actually got them back. So it's interesting that she was a very pious lady as well. I mean, to go on this raiding party and it was purely to get back these saints' relics. It wasn't about getting more land for themselves or anything like that. So it shows that she wasn't just like a warrior queen, but she was also pious. She was also, Christian. Do you know much about, the relics and, this raid into the Danelaw, Max?
No, I don't know much about the relics. I think basically what it shows, though, is that, you know, use the term a sort of warrior queen. And I think that it's fairly evident from what took place that she was that kind of a character. She wasn't the sort of queen that would sit back in safety in her sort of capital city or whatever, in her castle, whilst others fought and died on the battlefield. She was somebody who was seen as a central motivating force and the type of monarch who led her armies into battle.
And she must have also been brought up with the liberal arts. She must have been educated by her father. I mean, we heard about the revival that he brought about in education and learning, and there was a similar revival happened in Mercia under Æthelflæd. Mercian scholarship had high prestige at the courts of Alfred and Edward. Worcester was able to preserve considerable intellectual and liturgical continuity, and with Gloucester became the centre of a Mercian revival under Ethelred and Ethelfled that extended into the more unstable areas of Staffordshire and Cheshire. Charters show the Mercian leaders supporting the revival by their generosity to monastic communities. In 883, Ethelred granted privileges to Berkeley Abbey, and in the 890s, he and Ethelfled issued a charter in favour of the Church of Worcester. In 901, Ethelfled and Ethelred gave land and a golden chalice weighing 30 mancuses to the shrine of St. Midburg at Much Wenlock Church. So it shows that they understood that the spirituality of their people was just important as everything else. I mean, to be giving all these things to the church, it just shows you how pious they were. And the church was involved in the teaching and the learning as well. I mean, that was how people learned to read. And also, I mean, at the time, you've got these problems with the Vikings. And as we heard with Alfred the Great, it got so bad that, you know, they couldn't even read Latin in the Saxon areas. And in Mercia, they've managed to have a liturgical continuity, which means that the church had managed to continue throughout all of this. They'd managed to protect it, and it was obviously important to them. Do you know much about these support of the church here? Max, did that figure in your research?
No, that's not something that I've looked into. No.
Well, then, I do find the church history interesting. Well, then Ethelfled becomes de facto ruler. Ethelred's health probably declined at some stage in the decade after Alfred died in 899, and Ethelfled may have become the de facto ruler of Mercia by 902, although her husband didn't actually die until 911. The accession of a female ruler in Mercia is described by the historian Ian Walker as one of the most unique events in early medieval history. I think there was actually a tradition with the Saxons that they wouldn't ever allow a woman to rule. They wouldn't ever allow a queen to rule because they had this bad queen who, I'm trying to remember the actual story. I think she went to Rome and she was asked by the king there, or one of the kings there, do you want to marry me or do you want to marry my son? And she said, oh, I'd much rather marry the son. I mean, you know, she'd much rather have the younger guy rather than the actual king. And because she had said that, she was reduced to penury and reduced to rags. And she'd actually been like a very bad person as well. I can't remember if she'd killed her husband or something like that. So the Saxons said, well, we're never going to have a queen. We will never have a queen on the throne. And that's a tradition that's written about that the early Britons thought was interesting or strange, bizarre, because of course we'd had Boadicea, we'd had famous queens before in the past, but the Saxons refused to have that. So that's why this is such a unique event in medieval history. And they didn't actually make her queen, but she ruled as if she was queen. She became the de facto ruler in 902. She was never actually made into the de jure ruler. They never actually crowned her as queen or anything like that, but she had the same powers as the king. Do you recall that myth at all, Max? I think it's in the life of Alfred the Great.
I'm not familiar with any other female rulers of any parts of Britain apart from Boadicea prior to Ethelfled. And so my belief at the moment, I might be wrong, but my belief at the moment is that Ethelfled was the first queen of any part of England. And so in that respect, you know, together with Boadicea, she ranks as two almost unique characters. And it wasn't really until Elizabeth I that there was a queen who ruled all of England effectively. And so you know, that's why I felt that Ethelfled, you know, ranks with these other great historic characters, and why her life is so unusual, because you know, as a woman, you know, you're quite right that in those sort of medieval times, even if a man had a right to the throne, if the man was sickly or feeble, then they would be overlooked, and they would be replaced by somebody else who was younger and fitter. And so the very fact that Ethelfled succeeded her husband and went on to lead military campaigns in conjunction with her brother illustrates that she must have been quite a formidable character from the, in the physical sense. She must have been a swordswoman, and she must have been a warrior in her own right for her to have been accepted as the queen at those times, or in that time.
Boadicea was Welsh. She was Britonic. I think it was in the second century. Boadicea, so it was before the Saxons had actually come over. So actually like a different people. And then you got the Saxons who refused to have a queen. And then they had Æthelflæd. And I didn't know that, was it Elizabeth I that you said that was the first one to rule England? Yeah. So there you got the continuity there. And you do get these exceptions to the rule. And we've always supported them, whether we were the Britons back in the second century, whether we were the Saxons here in the ninth century, or whether we were the United Kingdom under Elizabeth I. It's, we never oppressed women. That's a nonsense. Okay. Well, we're going to get back into talking about Æthelflæd, the Lady of the Mercians. Who was born 870 AD and died 12th of June 918. And we talked about how we knew that she was important because she barely appears in the Saxon Chronicle. And the fact that she appears in Irish records and Mercian records, that tells us that she's fairly important, especially to make it over there into the Irish records. We talked about her rescuing the relics of the saint from the Danelaw. We talked about the Mercian revival, which was like the Alfredian revival, a revival in learning and religiosity. And we talked about how Æthelflæd became the de facto ruler while her husband was still alive, because he was fairly ill. And we had a discussion about her being queen and about the fact that she wasn't actually referred to as queen. And I brought up a story that was in the life of Alfred, which explained why the Saxons refused to have a queen over them. And it's quite an interesting story. As I say, it's from the life of King Alfred the Great that was written by Bishop Asser, who came from Wales. And one of the interesting parts about it is that it implies that the Welsh didn't have this tradition, because they thought it was quite a strange tradition, Bishop Asser did. And of course, the Welsh had Boadicea, but the Saxons didn't actually have any queens. And you were looking into this as well, Max, and you discovered that there weren't any until quite later on. I mean, what was it you were saying? When was it the first time that they actually had another queen after this?
Well, from Boadicea, you've got to go all the way through to, I think it was a Queen Jane, just prior to Bloody Mary, and then Elizabeth I. And I think that Jane, Lady Jane Grey, I think it was. I think she reigned for just 9 days before she died, or was replaced, because she was born during a period of political upheaval following the death of Henry VIII, and then Mary the First, who became Bloody Mary, she acceded to the throne, but she then married the King of Spain, and so she ruled England in partnership with him. And then after her death, it was Elizabeth the First who then became the next monarch who ruled as a queen on her own, effectively. So between Boadicea and Elizabeth I, Æthelflæd was the only English, she would have been Mercian or Anglo-Saxon queen to have existed throughout that entire period of what must have been something like 1300 years. And so that sort of sets her apart as a woman of unique qualities and unique ability. The fact that she, and despite the fact that she's not mentioned very much in the Saxon Chronicle, she is mentioned as Lady of the Mercians in the Mercian Chronicle version of the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle. And she's also referred to as the Queen, and she's also referred to as the Queen in Welsh texts of the time as well. So she was regarded as a queen, and the history of her reign shows that she controlled the armies and she directed her soldiers, etc., and was a warrior queen in the same kind of mould as Boadicea and Elizabeth I.
So it would have been almost 1,000 years then between the Lady of Mercia and Jane, Queen Jane. That was
more than 1,000 years, I would have thought.
Well, we'll start with, as I say, this is reading from Asser's Life of King Alfred the Great, and this is part 13, Judith's position in Wessex, and this is actually talking about Alfred's father's wife, Ethelwulf. When Ethelwulf, therefore, returned from Rome, the whole nation, as was fitting, so rejoiced in the arrival of their ruler that, if he had allowed them, they would have expelled his unruly son Ethelbald with all his counsellors from the kingdom. That's because his son Ethelbald had mistreated them all. But he, as I have said, acting with great clemency and prudent counsel, would not act in this way, lest the kingdom should be exposed to peril. He likewise bade Judith, daughter of King Charles, whom he had received from her father, take her seat by his own side on the royal throne, without any dispute or enmity from his nobles, even to the end of his life, although contrary to the perverse custom of that nation. For the nation of the West Saxons does not allow the queen to sit beside the king, nor to be called queen, but only the king's wife, which refusal, or rather reproach, the chief persons of that land say arose from a certain headstrong and malevolent queen of the nation, who did all things so contrary to her lord and to the whole people, that not only did the hatred which she brought upon herself bring to pass her exclusion from the queenly throne, but also entailed the same corruption upon those who came after her ever since. In consequence of the extreme malignity of that queen, all the inhabitants of the land banded themselves together by an oath, never in their lives to let any king reign over them who should bid his queen take her seat on the royal throne by his side. And because, as I think, it is not known to many whence this perverse and detestable custom first arose in Wessex, contrary to the custom of all the Germanic peoples, it seems to me right to explain it a little more fully, as I have heard it from my lord Alfred the Truth-Teller, king of the Anglo-Saxons, who often told me about it, as he also had heard it from many men of truth who related the fact, or I should rather say expressly preserved the remembrance of it. And I find that interesting because, you know, this is the guy writing Alfred's autobiography for the Saxons, and he's calling their custom perverse and detestable. And, you wouldn't expect that. But, and that shows you that the Britons didn't go along with this custom, but it was very, very ingrained in amongst the Saxons. And King Charles, that it says here, I think that was Charlemagne that actually gave his daughter to King Alfred's father. It was King Alfred's mother. Do you want to comment on any of that at all, Max?
No. I think it's all fairly self-explanatory.
Okay, well, we'll move on to the next section. Offa and Edeber. There was in Mercia in recent times a certain valiant king who was dreaded by all the neighbouring kings and states. His name was Offa, and it was he who had the great dyke made from sea to sea between Wales and Mercia. His daughter, named Edeber, was married to Beortric, king of the West Saxons. The moment she had possessed herself of the king's goodwill, and practically the whole power of the realm, she began to live tyrannically, after the manner of her father. Every man whom Beortric loved, she would execrate, and would do all things hateful to God and man, accusing to the king all whom she could, thus depriving them insidiously either of life or of power. And if she could not obtain the king's consent, she used to take them off by poison, as is ascertained to have been the case with a certain young man beloved by the king, whom she poisoned, seeing that she could not accuse him to the king. It is said, moreover, that King Beortric unwittingly tasted of this poison, though the queen had intended to give it not to him, but to the young man. The king, however, was beforehand with him, and so both perished. So she actually ended up killing the king. She was such a horrible witch. It doesn't end there, though. we get Edeburgh's further life. King Beortric, therefore being dead, the queen, since she could no longer remain among the Saxons, sailed beyond the sea with countless treasures and came to Charles, king of the Franks. As she stood before the dais, bringing many gifts to the king, Charles said to her, "Choose, Edeburgh, between me and my son, who stands with me on this dais." She, without deliberation, foolishly replied, "If I am to have my choice, I choose your son, because he is younger than you." At which Charles smiled and answered, "If you had chosen me, you should have had my son, but since you have chosen him, you shall have neither me nor him." However, he did give her a large convent of nuns, in which, having laid aside her secular habit and assumed the dress worn by the nuns, she discharged the office of abbess for a few years. As she is said to have lived irrationally in her own country, so she appears to have acted much more so among a foreign people, for being finally caught in illicit intercourse with a man of her own nation, she was expelled from the monastery by the order of King Charles. Henceforward, she lived a life of shame in poverty and misery until her death, so that at last, accompanied only by one slave, as I have heard from many who saw her, she begged her bread daily at Pavia, and so wretchedly died. I think it's an interesting tale, and I think that may be the origin of the phrase age before beauty. Do you think maybe age before beauty? Because that's what she's saying.
Interesting story.
But that's the moral of the story, isn't it? You know, she chose beauty before age. I mean, people always say age goes before beauty. I mean, it's just like a common phrase. And because she chose beauty instead, because she chose his son, she lost everything. Whereas if she had said him, like the age, she would have been given the beauty anyway. He would have given his son to marry. But that's the reason why the Saxons refused to have a queen. And that custom must have gone on, as we were saying, that must have gone on for a thousand years. Almost a thousand years.
Which again sort of shows what an exceptional person Æthelflæd must have been to have persuaded them to overcome that.
Very much so, very much so. Well, let's get back to the story of Æthelflæd herself, and we'll go back to 902. At this time, according to the three fragments, the Norse Vikings were expelled from Dublin and then made an abortive attack on Wales. When this failed, they applied to Æthelflæd, her husband being ill, for permission to settle near Chester. Æthelflæd agreed, and for some time they were peaceful. The Norse Vikings then joined with the Danes in an attack on Chester, but this failed because Æthelflæd had fortified the town, and she and her husband persuaded the Irish among the attackers to change sides. Other sources confirm that the Norse were driven out of Dublin in 902, and that Æthelflæd fortified Chester in 907. Æthelflæd refounded Chester as a borough, and she is believed to have enhanced its Roman defences by running walls from the northwest and southeast corners of the fort to the River Dee. Simon Ward, who excavated an Anglo-Saxon site in Chester, sees the later prosperity of the town as owing much to the planning of Æthelflæd and Edward. So these three fragments, they must have come from Ireland, and this must be why the Irish have got records of this, because they kicked the Vikings out and they went to Æthelflæd, and then they broke their oath and they tried to invade Chester, and only they failed, and Æthelflæd managed to put them down, and also with the help of the Irish among them who changed sides.
Yes.
So he must have been very diplomatic, and they must have known, there must have been a more powerful force as well for the Irish to say, look, we're going to change and we're going to support the Saxons instead of the Norse.
One of the things you learn from this is just what a turbulent period politically that was in English history or British history. A very, very turbulent period with people changing sides and all sorts of alliances growing up, all sorts of tribal groupings all trying to find their place and expand their area of influence.
Now, once they had expanded their area of influence, the important thing was to build up these fortifications. You know, they weren't sort of sitting on their laurels. It was because she built up the Roman defences in Chester that they were able to defeat these Vikings. And Alfred had actually built a network of fortified boroughs, and in the 910s, Edward and Æthelflæd embarked on a program of extending them, which would stand her in good stead in later years when attacked by the Norsemen. Among the towns where she built the fences were Wednesbury, Bridgnorth, Tamworth, Stafford, Warwick, Cherbury, and Runcorn. So she went on quite a building spree there. Do you want to comment on these boroughs and these defences that she built?
Well, I think it's a reflection, really, that both Edward and Æthelflæd continued Alfred's policy and shared his outlook, which was that the times for raiding and stealing wealth from other people were over, and that if nations or if peoples and communities wanted to be wealthy, then they needed peace. And they needed peace so that they could trade and so that they could grow crops, etc., in order to build their wealth, and that it was necessary for them to pay a price for that peace by paying taxes to a monarch who would then have an army sufficient to keep the other raiding tribes at bay. And so this is really the period during which there would have been the formation of the notion of noblesse oblige on the part of the monarchs, where there would have been a kind of unwritten pact between the people and the monarch, that the people would pay taxes in order to keep the monarch in great luxury, and in return for that great luxury, the monarch would therefore be beyond the bribery of hostile peoples, and would in return for that that wealth would then devote themselves and their families to the defense of the nation, and would be prepared to give their lives in defense of the nation, and so it was a pact between monarchy or between aristocracy and the people.
Interesting to see that they're carrying on Alfred's vision as well, and carrying on with the process he developed of building up these defences and educating the people, and as you say, taking taxes from them to pay for the standing army and for the fortifications. Yep. In 917, invasions by three Viking armies failed when Æthelflæd sent an army to capture Derby and the territory around it. The town was one of the five boroughs of the Danelaw, together with Leicester, Lincoln, Nottingham, and Stamford. Derby was the first to fall to the English, but she lost four of her thanes, who were dear to her, in the battle. Tim Clarkson, who describes Æthelflæd as a renowned and competent war leader, regards the victory at Derby as her greatest triumph. At the end of the year, the East Anglian Danes would submit to Edward, her brother. So do you think here that she would go in there and attack, and then they would submit to her brother rather than to her? Was that the sort of process that was going on here?
I think it's fairly clear that Æthelflæd and Edward the Elder worked as a kind of a partnership. You know, in the same way that her husband, Æthelred, had accepted the overlordship of Alfred, I think that Æthelflæd probably recognized that she would need to ultimately bow to the overlordship of her brother, but because of the great partnership they had between the two of them, she was allowed by Edward to continue to exercise the powers of a monarch in Mercia, and they worked as a partnership. So she would have applied pressure on them, and it perhaps just so happened that it was Edward that delivered the final blow that caused the Danes to submit. But it could well just have been that. I would imagine that Edward would have been applying the pressure, and that they may have submitted to Æthelflæd had things been slightly different.
Yeah, I mean, they might have found it a bit embarrassing submitting to a woman. I mean, they're being defeated by a woman here. And don't forget, I mean, three Viking armies failed when Æthelflæd's army kick their ass, basically. I mean, that is quite a failure there, to be defeated by this woman's army. And don't forget, it was all started by these armies invading Æthelflæd's area. But in early 918, Æthelflæd gained possession of Leicester without opposition, and most of the local Danish army submitted to her. A few months later, the leading men of Danish-ruled York offered to pledge their loyalty to Æthelflæd, probably to secure her support against Norse raiders from Ireland. But she died on the 12th of June 918 before she could take advantage of the offer. No similar offer is known to have been made to Edward. According to the Three Fragments, in 918, Æthelflæd led an army of Scots and Northumbrian English against forces led by the Norse Viking leader Ragnall at the Battle of Corbridge in Northumbria. Historians consider this unlikely, but she may have sent a contingent to the battle. Both sides claimed victory, but Ragnall was able to establish himself as ruler of Northumbria. In the Three Fragments, Æthelflæd also formed a defensive alliance with the Scots and the Strathclyde British, a claim accepted by Clarkson. So she actually managed to get the whole of the Danelaw. They all pledged their loyalty to her, and then she died. And then I believe that it was actually Edward that took those lands after they had been pledged to Æthelflæd. Is that correct, Max?
Yeah, I believe so. So Edward then became the monarch of all of England apart from Northumbria. And it was then for his son Æthelstan who inherited, well, he didn't directly inherit the throne. There was another brother who was in between, but Æthelstan eventually became the king of Wessex and a claimant of the throne of all England, but who then fought with the Northumbrians and eventually forced them to submit, and so therefore became the first king of England.
She must have had a really formidable reputation. I mean, Leicester is just submitting to her without any opposition, and then a couple of months later, York pledges their loyalty to her. And I mean, all she's actually done is fought this one battle for Derby, and then the reputation of that was so much that these other Danes just surrendered to her, basically.
I think to some extent these sort of things follow the same course that is followed when you play Monopoly. If you play Monopoly, once somebody starts to win, it then becomes far more likely that they're going to win because they just have the greater resources, and it kind of creates a snowball effect. And I think that she would have had the early victories, and then as a result of those victories, she would have enlisted the survivors, even the enemy survivors from the previous battles would have been enlisted into her armies, and her army would then just have snowballed in terms of size, and she would have then would have appeared incredibly formidable to any of the fragments that of the British Isles that were still trying to resist English authority, or the authority of the English throne.
I think there's some. Also, it seems to me that it's the winner is the one who's the first to team up, because if you look at this, you've got the Danes are fighting against the Norse. You've got Norsemen from Ireland that are invading the Danes, and they're fighting amongst themselves, whereas the Saxons are joining up together. And in the history of the kings of Britain, when Geoffrey of Monmouth writes about at the end, he writes about the reasons why the British failed to defeat the Saxons, and he says it's because the British failed to team up together. They were still fighting amongst one another, as well as fighting against the Saxons, but the Saxons weren't so prone to fighting amongst themselves. And you've got the same thing here. You've got the Danes that are fighting among themselves, and you've got the Saxons that have teamed up, and then you get the Danes wanting to join the winning side, and they join up with the Saxons. There's a lot of praise for Æthelflæd. She is praised by Anglo-Norman chroniclers such as William of Malmesbury, who described her as a powerful accession to Edward's party, the delight of his subjects and the dread of his enemies, a woman of enlarged soul. And according to Pauline Stafford, like Elizabeth I, she became a wonder to later ages. In Nick Higham's view, medieval and modern writers have been so captivated by her that her brother Edward's reputation has suffered unfairly in comparison. I'll just stop there. Where he mentions a woman of enlarged soul, I think that's referring to her piety. When she went and rescued the saints' relics, and they built churches, and they gave land to the churches, and she was following in her father's footsteps there, of being very religious, whilst at the same time being this warrior queen. Do you want to make a comment there, Max?
Perhaps you could interpret it that the word soul could mean vigor, and she could just be seen as a woman who was a ball of energy, who didn't balk at anything, who was determined, and who determined and unafraid. You know, that same kind of connotation. That sort of connotation could be put on that statement. But it sounds as though both were probably true. And just going back to your previous point with regard to the Saxons working together, I think that it was the partnership between Æthelflæd, who was queen of the Mercians, and Edward the Elder, who was the king of Wessex, that meant that they didn't have to defend their own border, the border between the two of them, which then meant that they would proportionately, for a kingdom of the size that they were, they therefore had more men to place at the actual hostile borders, which meant that when they then encountered their hostile enemies, they had more troops and therefore more likely to win. And again, sorry to sort of refer back to another board game, but in my youth, I've played lots of board games to what I would regard as quite a high standard. But a lot of people will be familiar with the board game Risk. With Risk, once you start to build an empire, if you form an alliance with somebody else so that you don't have to defend the border between your two empires, it then always creates a winning alliance, and you then sort of battle through till it's just the two of you left in the board game, and then you just fight each other for who's going to actually win the game. But if you get two powerful kingdoms that are side by side and they form an alliance such they don't have to defend their internal border, that is a success factor in terms of statecraft.
Well, they didn't have to defend the border against Wales either. I mean, you think about it. I mean, you got Alfred that united the Wessex and united the Saxons, and also he was on good terms with the Welsh. Don't forget, it was Bishop Asser from Wales that was writing the life of King Alfred, and it tells us in that the Welsh went to him for protection. So he's got all of southern England. He's got southern Wales. And then they've got Mercia as well, and it's just this Danelaw bit in the north of England that they needed to take, so they had the whole of England and Wales, and then they could start forming this, you know, this national feeling amongst the English and the Welsh, and eventually the Scots as well. And this was the first bit where they really had the whole of England, and you got this feeling of the English being a nation. Æthelflæd is vitally important to the building of the English as a nation, basically, just as important as Alfred the Great, her father. The Irish and go on.
And it's also interesting just how readily the kings of Ireland, the kings of Wales, or the lords in Wales, because they may not necessarily regard themselves as a kingdom, but the lords and the kings, the aristocrats in those areas, and also Scotland, how readily they formed alliances between each other, with an alliance between the Scots and some of the Irish, and the armies under Æthelflæd and Edward to fighting against the Northumbrians. And so therefore what this actually demonstrates is that the schism that is quite often overemphasized in modern politics by people who try to promote Scottish nationalism and Irish nationalism and Welsh nationalism is actually a bit of a myth, and it's something that's actually a more recent invention than most people would think. Now, you'd have thought that the further back you go into antiquity, the greater would be the sense of nationhood amongst those peoples, and the greater would be the antipathy towards domination by England, as all the political domination that eventually came from England later on. But in reality, the opposite is the truth. The closer you get to modern times, the more emphasis is placed upon dividing the peoples of the British Isles by making the peripheral parts of the British Isles appear to be far more alienated from any sense of unity. And I think that that's something that people need to understand, so that we can perhaps look forward to a time in future when the whole of the British Isles will be united under a single administration. And I think that would be the recipe that from a statecraft point of view, that would be most beneficial for all of the people of the British Isles.
I think the schism really began with Cromwell. I mean, he destroyed parts of Wales, he destroyed parts of Ireland, he killed the king, he banned Easter, I think he might have banned Christmas as well, smashed up churches, destroyed shrines. I mean, the man was just a total Bolshevik. He was just an absolute devil, Cromwell was. I mean, there are people still furious at Cromwell in Ireland today, there's still people furious at Cromwell in Wales today. Whereas when you go back further in time, and even before the building of the Anglo-Saxon kingdoms and the alliances with the Welsh, before then, when you had the Britons, who then became the Welsh, when they were fighting against the Romans, they all united behind a Pendragon. And you hear of Arthur the Pendragon. And at the times that the island was facing, you know, invading armies, they would all unite together under one king who was their battle king, basically. And once they managed to defeat them, then they would go back to having their singular kingships. Like after Julius Caesar was sent packing that first time, they went back to their singular kingships. But the earliest records that we have show that the peoples of England, Scotland, Ireland and Wales, they all got on well together. They didn't fight amongst themselves. They saw themselves as part of the same nation. And then it happened again after Ethelfled and with the United Kingdom, but then it was damaged by Cromwell. That's the way that I see it anyway. I've got some more.
I would agree with that as a general principle. It's a great pity that subsequent English monarchs abused the power that the life's work of people like Ethelfled and Edward the Elder gave them, and it would have been far better if they'd concern themselves with creating a nation throughout the entire British Isles.
Well, I think a lot of it was carrot rather than stick as well. I mean, if you read about King Alfred, a certain amount of money was put by so that anybody that visited the court, meaning, you know, foreign diplomats, Irish kings, princes from the continent, any of them turned up at the court, then they were lavished with gifts. You know, they could have whatever they wanted, so it wasn't you know, threatening them, you will be under my overlordship like Cromwell. It was more a question of competing as to who could give the greatest gifts. It was a very, very different way of doing things. So they must have been excellent diplomats. Ethelfled must have been a very, very good diplomat, as well as a warrior. The Irish and Welsh annals described her as a queen, and the annals of Ulster, which ignore the deaths of Alfred and Edward, and they describe her as renowned Saxon queen. So the Irish and the Welsh are still quite happy to call her a queen, but the Saxons, because of that tradition, they call her a Lady of Mercia. Pauline Stafford describes Ethelfled as the last Mercian queen, referred to in charters in such terms as by the gift of Christ's mercy ruling the government of the Mercians. Well, the first and last, really. I mean, the kings all had wives, but they weren't actually referred to as queens. And I don't know of any that actually had a role like this, as in de facto ruler. But again, this tells us how important she was outside of England, outside of Britain. You know, this is the annals of Ulster. So you're in Northern Ireland there. Do you want to add any more to that, Max?
No. I think we've ably demonstrated everything that people need to know. And I think that certainly in modern day education in schools, I would think that Ethelfled probably doesn't get a mention. But I think that it's something that that we ought to encourage. And that's something that hopefully will be rectified, because I think that there are individual women that have made a massive contribution to the formation and to the well-being of our nation, and that should be recognised.
I think if you're a nationalist, you should know your history, and you should know the important men and women of your history, and you should take inspiration from them, and that helps you to understand who you are and what your strengths are and your place in history, and give you a sense of not just being here living in the now, but actually part of a long chain that goes back into the past of great people. So I'm really enjoying this series. I know a lot of you listeners out there are enjoying it as well. Thank you very much for listening, and do watch out for more Greatest Britons at RadioAlbion.com in the future.